Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We continue our expectations series today. We're going to talk about Nick Dawkins, the UDFA center, and Mike Green, the edge rusher and second round pick last year. Joining me to do that is Nick Mehta. Nick, how you doing?
Doing great, Ken. Excited to talk about two young players. One of them's got a lot to do this spring and summer. The other one we want to see a lot out of in the fall.
Yep. Well, definitely players who actually, I think, really important seasons for both. It's hard for me to ever say that there's ever really a not important season for a player, but there are seasons with very low expectations. Dawkins has low expectations, but also he has a fairly short window, as I would look at it. He's, for those of you who know, he's a UDFA center from Penn State, 6'4", 305, so he's got pretty good size for a center. And arms that reportedly are almost 34 inches long, 33.75. Now, that I believe is a pro day measurement. I look at it with a jaundiced eye, but still, that's a fairly extreme number.
Yeah, and you know, even if you knock off 3/4 inch, 33 inches is pretty good for Dawkins. You know, you mentioned the tighter timeline. He's 24 years old. You know, not like he was a sixth-year senior, but only a two-year starter. And so he's in that kind of weird spot where he's a lot older, but he doesn't necessarily bring a ton of starting experience. Just 2 years of Big Ten starting experience and a good program. But, you know, that's not necessarily a ton of playing time for a sixth-year senior. You know, his undrafted rookie, he has an opportunity, too, as an undrafted rookie in Baltimore, right? Not only in Baltimore, but at the center position where they need to find a starter this year. And potentially, like, you know, even if they're looking at a third-string backup, kind of role, like it's not entirely clear who fills those roles for the Ravens this year. So there's an opportunity here. He's here in Baltimore with his teammate Venga Iwane. So there's, you know, they have some built-in chemistry there, although we'll see how much they actually get to work together in terms of first, second team reps in the spring and summer. But yeah.
So I want to go back to something you said earlier, because his age is really a significant factor relative. He's turned 24 just this month. So his age is very significant when you look at the fact that in 25, he had his only good college season. And he did that at age 23 and a half. So that carries its own kind of a stigma to it. And prior to that, he wasn't very good in 2024 and before. He did play in 24, played more time. Wasn't nearly as efficient as a pass blocker, frankly didn't have a lot of snaps even before then in his previous 3 years where he had any snaps. And you mentioned he's a 6 year player, probably a red shirt season or something in there as well. Does have a kind of a poor aggregate penalty rate of one every 147.2 in college. Five penalties this last season, eight penalties the year before. Have been a problem, and that's something that's kind of plagued the Ravens at center a little bit too.
Yeah, and so it's nice to see a guy take a leap, and I thought a pretty substantial leap, you know, certainly mm-hmm. statistically from his fifth to sixth year, but I think that they're coming into Baltimore too. It's a team that's not really, they can't have a developmental guy, you know, at center. This is not the kind of timeline for that. And so it's like there's a lot of growing he probably needs to do very quickly to even, you know, make a backup role. Because the other thing is maybe you land on a starter, right? But it doesn't quite work out. This is, you know, especially if it's one of the current guys on the roster, it's not hard to see them landing on a starter and that guy struggling and them looking to make the team looking to make a change. And so in that event, you really want to have a backup that you really feel is ready to go, not a developmental guy. Like when the Ravens had Tyler Linderbaum, right, there was no question about who was going to start. Yes, that, you know, you always need a backup center, but they were more focused on like keeping a developmental guy than they were a vet like the Colts kept Pinter for so long because they had, you know, centerpieces moving in and out the last couple of years. When you're in that situation, having a more developmental guy like that just isn't as functional for your center. He also doesn't have guard experience, so there's not the, you know, he can be a three spot developmental backup.
And I don't think he has the length to play guard, but I don't think there's any reason to believe he'd be transitioning to guard at the NFL level after a fairly inauspicious college run blocking career and having that be the role. But you're absolutely right about the Ravens have a very deep crew of somewhat experienced guys Pinter has played nearly 1,000 NFL snaps and seems to be the most senior of the group, which is actually pretty darn awful. Bullock has been with the Ravens for the last 2 years, and he is a bigger guy. And I'm going to talk about him later today with somebody else, and look forward to that. And then they have Gwynn, who is Ledford's baggage that he brought with him from Atlanta. That's a bad way to put it, but he's Ledford's guy. You know, that he brought with him from Atlanta, and you know, already appears to be within the top three, perhaps the number two guy now, as we watched OTAs on Tuesday. So it's a interesting lineup there. I think they've already got a lot of guys they have to get snaps at the top of that group in the preseason. It's going to be hard for Dawkins to earn those.
Yeah, that's another great point. It seems like with his size, he would benefit from cross training at guard at some point, whether that's in Baltimore or elsewhere. He is the size for it. He's a good athlete. He tested well. Sometimes I don't feel like the explosiveness that he tested with shows up on film in the same way off the snap, but he tested well. He seems to have pretty good, you know, lateral mobility. Obviously these are huge improvements in technique and footwork from his 2024 to his 2025 season. And I think, again, it's good to see a guy grow like that. But you wonder, does, you know, he has a good relative athletic score. He tested well. But when that doesn't show up on tape, that's another aspect of, okay, you have to kind of teach this guy how to use all the skills that he already has. For me, it shows up particularly in like reach blocks. I think especially moving laterally, he struggles. Again, I think it's more of a burst thing than anything else, because his agility climbing to the second level is pretty good. But he just can't really explode off the snap. He kind of similarly to Venga Ioane, at least in my view, someone who's like certainly more suited for inside zone than outside zone. Now, right. Obviously that's not to say he can't play it, but the difference with Ioane is that he's so good at everything else that any slight deficiencies in outside zone he has in terms of getting out there, he makes up for in a dozen other ways. Dawkins doesn't have that. I think one thing in particular is he has that length. I don't feel like he knows how to use that length especially well. And so as a run blocker, I feel like in pass protection, it's almost strange because sometimes he's good at mirroring and staying engaged, but I also feel like agile defenders cross his face too easily. The other thing I felt like is he doesn't lose slowly. He kind of locks on and doesn't lose, or he loses kind of quickly. And to me, that's really not what you want to see in a center. We saw how many issues the Ravens had if Linderbaum lost quickly last year, which happened really a lot more than it should have, and how quickly that just blows up a play.
Yeah, you don't want to have a guy who's getting regularly walked back, and regularly can mean 7% of the time, 5% of the time is too much. Centers don't give up a lot of pressures. They generally know where they're going right off the bat, or they should, and it can be a significant deficiency when a center is giving up a few. 2.5 per game is too much, and that really shows up in the way I score centers. They have a significantly more difficult grading scale that they have to hit because of the lower risk of interior pressures being given up, or at least a full interior pressures. I think it's going to be a very important time here for Nick Dawkins. And I don't think he has like forever. I think kind of, we're going to get into what a good and a great season is, but I think probably at this point, the best case is that he makes the practice squad, and that the Ravens can afford him a developmental opportunity that there. But I mean, at age 24, you know, 25 going into camp next year, there's no sure thing for this guy. He could be in trouble next year in a big way. I think, you know, he's got to somehow fight, probably hope that something happens. Honestly, that's where a lot of things are, opportunities born out of injury. And then take advantage of the opportunity when it's presented to him in terms of the time probably in the preseason. And I don't think there's any way though he's a developmental prospect like Carson Vinson was last year, who plays 178 preseason snaps, you know, about the most of anybody in the NFL. He's going to be fighting for second half opportunity to play. And then with that come all the context questions about, you know, so what? These are grocery baggers, you know, that he's blocking on the defensive line.
Yeah, it's so for me, there's also the element of Dwayne Ledford, right? And he has his big voice in that building. They're obviously hoping that he can do a lot with their younger offensive linemen. What does he kind of has this year to train under Ledford and make some big steps, you know, and work himself into a position to play more in the future. He's a smart player. He's a good football IQ. Very, very beneficial in a center. I felt like he was very good at finding work, picking up and passing off players, stunts and blitzers. These are all pluses of a, these are all the things that you expect of an older prospect, at least. You know, he didn't play as much, but he did spend that time studying and knowing what he's supposed to be doing. So there's already a good bit to work with, but looking at the trajectory in terms of him, he even making a practice squad, you'd have to think that requires the Ravens to carry all three of their top center options right
That's
now.
That's what Bullock, I was just going to hit you with
and Gwynn. Yeah. Now I could really see that because I think Bullock was a tackle. He can play guard. Pinter has played guard and center. I think Gwynn has also spent time at guard and center. So I could see them carrying all three of those and using two of them as kind of backups for all three interior spots. And that would leave space for Dawkins on the practice squad. But depending on how everything shakes out, you know, if he's the fourth center, it's possible there's not a spot for him even on the practice squad.
Right. Now, I was just going to ask you about that. I'll come back to it in 1 second because the supposition they could carry all three centers really requires almost that they carry 10 offensive linemen, which I don't think they'll do. They may, but you know, it would be a concession that they'd have to make other places on the roster, whether that means carrying a fourth running back. Rasheen Ali may not make the team. I don't think they're going to cut LaJonte Wester or any other wide receivers. I don't think there's a chance there. So it really comes down to fourth tight end or fourth running back has to be gone for there to be a 10th offensive lineman. I'm not saying it's not the right thing. I'm just saying that, you know, Ali will be a hard cut for the team to swallow. They'll swallow hard as they make it. I don't think there's a lot of takers for Ali out there. Just had a discussion with Jeff Z yesterday about him. And I think he actually makes it through to the practice squad just fine. And the Ravens could bring him back if needed. So that is one point in the favor of just cutting Ali. But let's talk about the offensive line you're discussing here. If Pinter, Bullock, and Gwynn all make the team, if Emory Jones as another backup, he'd be number four. Okay. You have your five starters that include the five starters do include one of those centers. Maybe there's an extra player there. I was saying you're going to already have to cut Voorhees in this group and include 10 to have a chance that you would have all three centers on the roster, but you actually could do it with 9. I'm trying to think of who's their other guard. I guess they'd have Bullock as a backup guard as well, and Jones as a backup guard would be what they'd be trying to roll with. Reasonable chance that Voorhees gets cut. I think we'd agree, right? Given the dollar amount that they've incremental dollar bonus he earned through the whatever system.
Yeah,
it is.
the PBE, the escalator. Yeah, so he'll be, you know, whatever, like $3 million or something like that in savings to cut, you know, a backup guard. And if you're really interested in moving on, you know, you have some, you have your, you know, at least one medium term, one long term guy at guard. You don't really need to hang on to Voorhees at this point. There's really no arc to him starting in Baltimore again, quite frankly. I'm going through that line in my head, and I just really can't imagine a spot for Dawkins on the roster. Right. I think it would take injury, maybe plural.
So if you're going down the list of the guys ahead of him, to me, it looks like it's Pinter, Gwynn, Bullock in some order. I won't say what necessarily. Then an acquisition is the fourth guy, and then Dawkins would maybe be the fifth guy. How do you even get snaps in that situation? I mean, we see how difficult it is for the fourth quarterback. I mean, Diego Pavia or Fagnano are hardly getting any snaps right now. And Lamar isn't even there. You know? So is it really a you know, a possibility that he get there. Anyway, should get some practice.
Well, and there's also Evan Bearson, you know, a guy who could get some center reps or at least get some center flexibility. I can't remember if he lined up there in college or not, but I think he did it one of the All-Star games that he was at. He was practicing at center. And so you could even argue he is also in front of Dawkins right now because the Ravens drafted him and not Dawkins. Again, such a late pick is also kind of a calculation of who you think you can sign as an undrafted free agent or not. So that's not super instructive, but they're still like, it's not even like he is the undisputed top rookie center. There's, you know, another guy that, you know, has a four-year contract too, which is something that you and I've talked about before, is the, you know, keeping a draft pick versus an undrafted free agent. You deal with that restricted free agent issue in the fourth year, whereas a guy that you draft, you have for 4 years, seventh rounder, very, very cheap.
Yeah, you have him cheap. Of course, it doesn't always hold up. If you play him before that, as the Ravens did with Voorhees, you end up being put back in a bad situation of, can you keep him? But yes, absolutely.
But it's still cheaper than an RFA tag in that fourth year.
Yes, but the RFA tag is not guaranteed. So that if they RFA tag him, then they can negotiate that price down. So they've done that in the past with two players. It was two players. It was, I think it was Jensen and Hurst, maybe in the same year, were reaching that point, and they just slashed both of their salaries. Yeah, they might even talk to them at the same time. And
you
and
can said, get hey, a player to take a play cut from the PPE as well.
Okay, have not heard that, and it's I have asked that question, and I had not heard that, but that's interesting because you know you would think that that's something that players would want to be fixed, but I guess the players also have an interest of making a team somewhere, and they don't want that, so they don't want to be cut just to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think if they've reached it, typically they have some kind of value. I do think that the standards are a little low, but if I'm wrong correctly, there was a situation with the Giants where Joe Shane wanted, Nick McCloud, the cornerback, to take a pay cut from his PPE, and he refused, and so the team cut him. I mean, I think from just a, you know, propriety perspective, that's, you know, probably not how the system should be implemented in some way, but still, it's not. The RFA pay cuts are also not something that happens super frequently. Anyway, we're digressing into the weeds a little bit.
Fair enough. Okay, well, let's go with a good season. What does a good season for you look like for Nick?
I think it's making the practice squad and staying on it the whole year and staying healthy. Even if he's on the practice squad, based on the roster outlook we've talked about, I think it's even hard to say good includes practice squad elevations just because that's still a really tough path. But I think just hanging on the practice squad for a year, getting a full year under Ledford, could be really good for him because again, there is a foundation there to develop. It's just, he doesn't have that much time to do it.
Right. I've got essentially the exact same thing you just said. I'll read it to you. Stays healthy, practices well enough, and flashes in the preseason to secure practice squad spot as a developmental lineman. No expectation of player promotion in 26, but practices with Ledford to improve his craft. So I think it's about as much as you can hope for. And I didn't even put something in there about, you know, he's in 53 or 90 man consideration for 2027, which is often part of how I describe these seasons. He's got very little runway to work with here. All right, what does a great season look like?
A great season is appearing in a regular season game. I think a really great season is him making the roster out of camp. I think a great season is him getting some playing time at some point as a rookie. Whether it's, you know, practice squad elevation comes up for a couple snaps, maybe there's like a, you know, week 18 doesn't matter and he gets a quarter or something like that off an elevation. But I think him seeing the field and getting a test of regular season competition in any way would be a great season for him because he'd get the chance to test it. The Ravens would get a chance to see like, okay, we've worked at him for X amount of months. How far has he gotten and what does that tell us about his trajectory?
Yeah. All right, that would certainly be very great if you got a game or a quarter or a half or whatever it would be in week 18. My great season, and again, I'll tell folks that the 60th percentile is a good season for me. The 80th percentile is a great season. So I'd have to believe there's a 20% chance of a significant amount of playing time for him to put that in the great season category. I don't think the chance is that high. So I had becomes a Ledford favorite via practice, work ethic, and improvement. Circumstances create an opportunity for promotion to the 53 as a backup, plays a few snaps as an injury replacement, enters 2027 in the Ravens 90 and 53 man roster discussion. All right. So not very, very low bar, frankly. And I think in both cases for what we expect Dawkins to do. And that's the nature of it. I mean, there's always people who are at the top of you know, this guy's going to make the team for sure out of the UDFA group. It's never for sure. It's almost always a function of what else is going on with the team, usually with injuries. And injuries, for example, made a great spot for Keon Martin last year to end up making the team when Kone and Longerbeam went down. But it just doesn't always work out. All right, let's go on. Let's talk about Mike Green. Pick number 59 out of Marshall in 25. Circumstances conspired to have him dropped to the Ravens, I'd say. Some black dots probably on some various NFL boards or their equivalent of it. And Mike fell into the Ravens' lap late and was forced into a very heavy role in his rookie year, I would say to his detriment.
Certainly, you know, the Ravens traded Odafe Owe early in the season. They, you know, dealt with a handful of other injuries. Kyle Van Noy was out early on. Tavius Robinson went on IR. And, you know, especially I think Tavius Robinson going on IR really hurt Mike Green because the Ravens needed more run defense snaps out of him, which coming out of the draft, everything everyone talked about was that was just not going to be his strength. That was, you know, he's a lighter guy. He's not great at holding the point of attack. A lot of his like run defense highlight plays in the in college were him penetrating using his athleticism. But in terms of, you know, the fundamentals of defense of edge run defender play, he had a lot to work on. And so he was thrown into that role a lot. The amount of snaps was a lot for a rookie. I don't know how much he played. I don't remember how much he quite played at Marshall, but with athleticism so important, right? Playing a lot of time can hurt you.
Okay, so 713 snaps for the Ravens as a rookie, and that's on defense. He played 119 more on special teams. So we're talking about a guy who played approximately 40 snaps per game, 39 and a half snaps per game maybe, on defense alone. And, you know, what we at least hope to see from Mike Green as a rookie was a big pass rush productivity season, one where, you know, we'd see an impact pass rush performance. He'd get to the quarterback. He'd have some sacks. He'd have more pressures. When he ended up having 399 pass rush snaps, and there's not a whole lot of guys who had, and I have this here. Where is it here? Yeah. Okay. There's 62 guys who had at least half of the maximum number of pass rush snaps in the league. And I think it was around 360, 370 snaps. So Mike Green was one of them. And he was 56th out of 62 in pass rush productivity at 5.0. And at Marshall, he'd been at 11.4 in the 97th percentile, 11th out of 408 the previous season. So big, big, big drop off. And, you know, it's a double jump in terms of the class level. So you think of normal coursing, of horse racing in Maryland, maybe, you know, he went from being a $5,000 claiming horse to a $25,000 stakes horse or something in one season. And that's a very difficult jump for anybody to make.
Yeah. I think one of the elements of his game that showed up in flashes was that bend around the edge, but it just felt like he was trying to get that so often, it just became very predictable. It was just typically his go-to way to beat rushers. The counter and the array of moves that you could see him showing at Marshall just weren't there. That feel for stringing together moves wasn't there. You know, one of the things I noticed when I was looking at his stats were his time to pressure and time to sack numbers were really high. Yeah. And for a speed guy, that's not what you want. It was more cleanups. I mean, really, it's hard to sugarcoat. Just a pretty disappointing season. I mean, he had 3.5 sacks, 7 tackles for loss, which is not horrific production. But then you think about how much time he played, and it's really just not enough from a second round pick with a first round billing. So that's, again, he was put in a tough spot, and so I think he has a lot to gain from all of the changes that the Ravens made this year. I think he may have benefited even more from Max Crosby than Trey Hendrickson, because Crosby is such a plus run defender. Hendrickson is not. And so maybe that's an opportunity for him to have even more pass rushing snaps. I'm curious to see how they arrange the snaps this year for him, because that to me is going to be a big part of his outcome, is what kind of opportunity set does he get?
And that's exactly true. So they will, I want to address multiple things you said there. There's a lot to unpack from that last little bit. Let's start with the time to pressure component, because you know his highlight play of the entire season was a 10-second quarterback hit on J.J. McCarthy that put away the Vikings game. And it was a great high motor play, never gave up on it, kept chasing him down. And it's a 4th-and-4 play. Your secondary is eventually going to screw it up and lose the coverage that they have. But he kept going and eventually got McCarthy on the ground. I think it was a 3-man rush, but it might have only been a 2-man rush on that play. It was a limited rush that the Ravens sent. And they finally got to him and put him away. That single play would have an impact over 10 seconds on a time to pressure kind of a number, unless they have caps for that kind of thing. So I'd have to look at a methodology of the source on that, but I'd be interested to see that. And the other thing you talked about was usage, was when does he actually get his snaps in 2026? So I have a thought of how it'll go right now, but the Ravens could entirely change that if they go out and decide, yeah, we really need to go out and get a Jadeveon Clowney or another pass rusher. And I think they still may do that. If that does, there's a couple guys who really lose out. One of them is Green, and the other is Adisa Isaac, who almost certainly is not making the team if that were to happen. Green, as it stands right now, I think you get a kick inside play from Zion Young on third down or Matabike, one or the other. You get Travis Jones, who will be in there at a regular pass rush feature on those downs. And then you'd get Hendrickson and Green would be the normal ones on the outside, which means that Hendrickson, who is almost exclusively a right side of the defense or opposite the left tackle pass rusher, apparently there's muscle memory or something that goes with that, because, for him, I'm saying, mm-hmm. because he's really never rushed from anywhere else. It's so rare, it's not even mentionable. But I think that means it puts Green onto that strong side where he has to do some other things to beat chipping players more often, beat a tight end more often. And that'll be an interesting, kind of a struggle for him. And he's a guy who played more on the other side in college.
Yeah, and then the question becomes, if the Ravens do add a Clowney, Green's pass rushing snaps off that side drop, does he end up playing some of both sides? I think there's kind of a wide range of potential usages and therefore a wide range of potential outcomes. The new coaching staff and the new scheme. There's a lot of talk about, Minter unlocked Dafe Owe, and you don't really know necessarily how much of that was Minter versus the position coach. It'll be interesting to see how they use Mike Green. I felt like the using him on stunts and in some of these more creative pressure packages wasn't as prevalent last year, and so I'm wondering if that's a way to get his athleticism more involved in the pass rush.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. For some, summer is their favorite season. Travel picks up, kids are out of school, and adventure is the focus. For others, juggling it all can be tough, can make you feel overwhelmed, and can make you count down the minutes until the kids are back in school. I know I look forward to summer as a time to take a break, but as a self-employed person, time spent away from my work is time I stress over wasting. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is a quality therapist who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial therapist matching for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right on the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session, based on 1.7 million client reviews. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com.
If he's going to be operating off that strong side and he's going to be dealing with a lot of point of attack, it's really a question of, can he get in there on Like, do you want him in there on a third and four, for example, against certain teams when you know that they're willing to run the ball? That's going to be an interesting question to see. And I think that's probably the biggest thing he's going to have to work on in terms of like more consistent playing time this year. And at the same time, like, he doesn't need to play the same number of snaps as he did last year.
That would be bad if he did.
But, you know, at the same time, you do like want a guy to grow into a, you know, rounded edge defender, you know, especially a second round pick. You don't want him to be a guy that you have to take off the field on a, you know, third and four against a run heavy team.
One of the things that the Ravens are missing right now is a Sam linebacker, a guy who can truly drop the coverage and be effective in that. And that, honestly, another area where Green didn't really do particularly well as a rookie. He had 40 coverage snaps, which was 9.1% of his pass snaps. So that's not an insignificant portion. I mean, that's more than it would be if it were Jadeveon Clowney, say. But he also gave up 10.6 yards per target on those plays. And it was about, how many targets was it? I think about it might have been 9 targets, and they were all complete, if I recall correctly, and 10.6 yards per target. Right now, the Ravens have Tavius Robinson, who's a rush side guy. They have Zion Young, who's always been a rush side guy. They have Green, who has been asked to play some Sam, but that's not a natural kind of a position for him. And they have Adisa Isaac, who, if he wants to make this team, he better be talking to the outside linebackers coach right away and saying, hey guys, can you get me reps at Sam? This is where I think I can contribute to this team. If that's not like first order of business for him, you know, as he shows up, he's missing what I think is a fairly narrow opening for him to make the team.
Being on the field at practice would probably help. I mean, he wasn't out there Tuesday's OTAs, and you're like, okay, he can't be injured again. Like, that's probably the number one thing that he's got to work on this year, is just staying on the field. But
you know, I didn't notice him at camp, by the way, on the side, whereas like Buchanan and Hamilton were both there on the side field. I don't know that Hamilton has an injury of any sort. And Kone was there and participated in the calisthenics and whatnot, but he wasn't in the 11 on 11s.
Yeah, same thing with, I think, Voorhees. And so, yeah, Isaac not even being there is not great in any event for his chances. You know, with and it kind of brings in the interesting question of, like, you know, building an edge room. And if you think about the overlap with, you know, Isaac's skill set with Mike Green, it's just there really isn't space for him, you know, like you're saying, in the kind of the rush group. He has the athleticism to make that switch. But at the same time, it's just a question of roster spots. Green really fills that speed rusher role in the room. And I think he stands to benefit from the addition of Hendrickson as a more consistent, you know, pocket pusher opposite him. And in the long term, it's a really nice complement to Zion Young. I mean, you could see that being a really nice long-term, you know, rush side power. I mean, I guess want Young to end up on the strong side as the better run defender, and maybe put Green on the right side of the defense, lined up over the left tackle in the long term.
If you put Young on the strong side, then he's got to have more coverage responsibilities. So I'd say opposite the naked tackle is where you'd prefer to have him. But I'm not sure that I know at this point exactly whether Zion or Tavius is the better coverage candidate. I'm not sure, but I think given his experience with the position in general and what he's done for the Ravens, that Tavius will get the opportunity to be the Sam as we start the season. But Young's tremendous compliment, I agree, to Hendrickson, because he'll play the early downs and he can kick inside. It's a double whammy of you can get value out of him that way. I think that's true of Tavius too, by the way.
Yeah, and so then you kind of think about how the Ravens have revamped this edge room and created a more cohesive one than they've had in the past. You know, like the year they had Owe and Kyle Van Noy, both were really productive, but behind them there wasn't much. And so, you know, it became very, very clear last year that they really need more production from, you know, their third and fourth edge guy. Now the problem is Kareem's position to be the number two. And so I think that sets, you know, some expectations for him as the number two edge rusher off the team, where he's going to need to produce in that capacity. Like we've been talking about, getting him in more opportunities for that, less run defense work, again, a huge benefit of drafting Zion Young is that you can have Young take on a lot more of those run defense snaps right away. Like even just those two as a short-term combo is a really good combination. So,
yeah, I'm with you. The one thing he did do fairly well last year, had a pretty decent finish rate, about 41% of his pressures using sack and QH contributions per PFF were sacks or quarterback hits. And that is a good number. There were flashes as a pass rusher. There's so many other deficiencies that I think that the path to get Mike Green to be a productive player is very clearly reduce his snaps, put him in a very specific pass rush specialization role where he can work on his pass rush. And you mentioned some of the elements with his move before. I don't disagree with any of it. I mean, he's jumping up in class. So there are some things that are hard to determine. I like the motor. I think that's still there, but I'm really concerned about, his ability to time in particular, the inside move that goes with that first look to the outside shoulder. You know, if you put a half man move on that guy and then you want to move inside, it does have to be timed up properly. You have to, have to deal with a more potent adversary in terms of his ability to put his hand on you and disrupt your plan. So I think that's what he needs to work on for a year here and not be, have all these run defense responsibilities. I don't think it should occur given how the roster is constructed.
Yeah. And in terms of him developing in terms of the move, he's also got, Trey Hendrickson, who's a really good example of a guy who worked hard to develop over the course of his career. They've got like fairly similar profile. I mean, they both have 32-inch arms. Green didn't do a ton of pre-draft testing, but his agility grades were elite, and so were, pretty similar numbers to Trey Hendrickson. I was looking before we started recording. Hendrickson like mentioned Mike Green by name in a recent interview, talking about why he's excited to be in Baltimore. So, I think a lot of times you get hyped up about veteran players mentoring younger players and making a big impact, and it's not always as consistent and as real of a thing as you'd like to see. But in terms of learning from a guy who, look, came out of college as like an explosive speed rusher and really needed to work on his craft of beating blocks and doing more than just blowing by guys, especially as a guy who played at FAU, right? There is some commonalities there and some reason to believe that Hendrickson could be a really great benefit to Green.
Yeah, I'm with you. Let's move on to what a good and a great season. What does a good season look like for you for Green?
Yeah, I think a good season, edge rushers is a little easier to talk statistically. I think a good season is getting up to, the range of 6 to 8 sacks. To me, that would also probably come with just a higher pressure rate, probably getting into like a double-digit pressure rate, maybe like a 12 to 14% pass rush win rates, something in those ranges where, he's consistently generating pressure. It's not just those flashes that you see. And I would actually say based on his finishing stats, that should result in something like on the higher end of 8 sacks in terms of a good season, because he's a good finisher. It's really just a matter of him generating that pressure consistently.
Okay. So if I were setting it, since I use 60th and 80th percentile for the two, I have to ask myself, is there a 40% chance of him getting 8 sacks or more if I make the claim you just have? Do you think that's a reasonable chance or you think it might be too high?
I think 6 to 8 is probably a better range.
Okay. All right. So I think I'm going to end up being very similar to you. I say active for every week he's healthy, plays at least 14 games, run defense and coverage impact are minimized as he's used situationally. PRP bounces back to a pass rush productivity to approximately the midpoint of the NFL. And that was 7.6 last year. His PRP this last year was 5.0. So he's got to have about a 50% increase in his pass rush productivity. Minter manages his snaps carefully to improve productivity. He maintains a significant passing down role, even if the Ravens bring in another vet pass rusher. That will be difficult. That will require Minter to curate his snaps effectively. And it may mean a very significant reduction in snaps. He may only play, 300 pass rush snaps plus another 120 snaps that are non-pass rush snaps. I mean, I could easily see a drop to 420. I think if we were being really hopeful about it, we'd say he only drops to 500 and he plays the vast majority of pass rush snaps. But, Minter's going to have to work to get him on the field for snaps that are on obvious passing situations to maximize his impact. And I think he will.
Yeah, I mean, I think the flip side of what I said earlier about how much does, you know, the defensive coordinator versus the positional coach benefit of players increases.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, I went to LA and suddenly a flip completely switched. The Chargers used him better. He felt that he talked about, you know, feeling like he was freed up to do more. Could certainly see Green, right, feeling that way. Last year, all the different things he's asked to do, dropping into coverage where he's not comfortable. You know, Minter clearly has some kind of a feel for how to use these guys, certainly in the kind of production he got in LA the last couple of years. So there's reason to believe that he's going to manage that. And again, the way that they've built the edge room this offseason really suggests that that's where they're headed.
And it's fair to say, I think, that if they got it, if they end up signing Jadeveon Clowney or even Kyle Van Noy or somebody else to be a veteran in the edge room and stay there, it's not a bad problem to have at all, because injuries will sort those problems out for you. You know, you'll have somebody get hurt and all of a sudden Mike Green's your number two again, even if it seems, you know, initially it seems like he's losing his number two spot to a player like Clowney. You know, as soon as the season is starting, that doesn't seem good. But I the Ravens would be very well served to not put themselves in the position where they have a pass rush deficit during the season that they have to fix then.
Right. And I think with Young and Robinson, you know, potentially being both primary run defenders this year, you have Green and Hendrickson, and you know, you kind of arguably are missing that fifth guy right now. You can have as high hopes for Adisa Isaac as you want, but he's just got to get on the field. I think the other thing about Clowney is, you know, he's obviously been more of a pass rush guy in his career, like pretty heavily weighted towards what he's played, but it's not like he is a bad run defender necessarily either. He can reduce inside as well. So I think even if the Ravens do sign him, you know, it will force Minter to get more creative. But I don't think it'll necessarily crater Green snaps. I just think it'll make him a lot more situational, and which could have the impact of actually improving his efficiency on a per snap basis.
Oh, it should.
Putting him in more consistent situations that are kind of perfectly suited to what his abilities are. And so there's an argument for that being ultimately the best path for a second round pick who had kind of disappointing rookie year, is kind of getting him back to what he's best at, building confidence and making an impact. And it's not like, you know, he's a second round pick who's a primary run defender. He's a second round pick who can be an impact edge rusher. And so, you know, like we're talking about in these projections, so much of his role is focused on what he can do in that respect.
With you entirely. And part of the thing that led to 713 snaps last year on defense was the fact that the Ravens offensively just could not sustain drives. They lost snap counts so dramatically. I don't remember what the thing was for the entire year, but they were like 19 snaps per game in the hole through 5 weeks. And that's per game. And that's absurd. I mean, a Jackson led offense with the team they have should be able to move the ball efficiently. They were over explosive in some games. I don't really mean that as a bad thing. So I'm just saying their explosiveness in that Buffalo game, for example, really hurt them in terms of the end result, because they couldn't sustain drives when they really needed to, and they scored very quickly, and the Buffalo responded in kind. I think that that's going to have to improve as a starting point. And we talk about Lamar Jackson improving all the other 21 players on the field. That's what I really mean is he'll make snap count a non-issue for the defense again, if he's healthy and has a big year, and the defense then can deal with a more well-rested and able to maintain their fourth quarter ability.
This is one of those things that makes this series, it's interesting every year, Ken, but this year especially, it's really, really interesting because of all the changes and all of the kind of adverse circumstances that players dealt with in various ways last year. Injuries, usage, playing time, start, stop, being on defense for, you know, 75% of the game. You know, those things really create a lot of tough circumstances, and it'll be interesting to see the extent to which guys are able to bounce back, the extent to which those issues remain in certain ways, and maybe it shows it's just part of who they are as a player as opposed to something that was based on, you know, situational. And so I think, you know, there's reason to be, you know, optimistic about Mike Green, because, you know, like we've said, there were the flashes last year. You could see what he is supposed to be. It's just, it didn't come out as often as it was supposed to be there.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. Let's move on to what a great season looks like for Mike Green.
I think a great season is eclipsing 8 sacks. I'm going to throw 2 forced fumbles in there because I also think, you know, turnover production on sacks is something the Ravens, you know, turnover production in general is something they need. I think he kind of can hold serve as a run defender. He's in a liability in that respect. Minimize his coverage responsibilities, I would say, almost no matter what. But showing some clear development on the run defense side, I think would also qualify in a great season. Everything you said about staying healthy, appearances, that kind of thing, is almost kind of built into him being able to have that kind of production. He's got to be able to stay on the field to do it. So I would say that's probably what I would see as a great season for him. I think in terms of, pressure rate, it's kind of hard for me to put a number on pressure rate sometimes. I think I would just look to see it probably above league average, but I would want to see him getting above league average, not at league average. I think good for him would be advancing to league average. His high finishing rate's going to maybe lead to some above average outcomes, in a good season. In a great season, I really want to see above average meaningful stats, not just his ability to get cleanup sacks from, his motor's going to have an impact this year because there are better pass rushers. So he could still get some good counting numbers off that, but I really do want to see the consistent high-level impact.
Some first pressures out of that. I agree with that. I'll go through mine real quickly here. Plays 15-plus games, improves more dramatically to fulfill original promise. Pass rush productivity is in the 8 to 8.5 range. That would put him around the 60th percentile. So I'm saying he's going to be in a situational role. There's a lot of great players on that list, by the way, of guys. And it's hard to figure out exactly who you're going to beat on that list of the guys who get a lot of pass rush snaps in this league. But if he's between 8 and 8.5, that would put him in about the 60th percentile. I think he could potentially get a very big assist for an improved secondary that improves the chance to get sacks. And also from the critical mass of the pass rush itself, that if they have Madubuike back, Travis Jones is the kind of force he was inside that drives the entire rush. We never talk about Travis Jones in that sense, or at least I don't hear it talked about otherwise. But he led the team in sacks last year, but he was by far the most dominant force in the pass rush. He's the guy who commands double teams on the inside. And when they finally have a year where they can match him up as a 3-tech on guards, you see just how incredible he can be to win one-on-one. But I think they have the pass rush critical mass to improve Green stats specifically. Green generates first pressures and motor makes him part of the cleanup crew. Ravens overall pass rush maintains a pace of approximately 3 sacks per game. By the way, won't do a lot of good if Green has a good year and it's at the expense of some other players, like Hendrickson is injured, which really wouldn't make Green a culprit for that in some way. But it's because, Hendrickson is losing snaps that it happened. By the end of the season, we're already talking about expanding his role again. So that would be the really great thing. He has this one purgatory season of a situational pass rush only. That's it. But this guy is too good an athlete to keep off the field. And that's our main discussion in the 2027 expectation series.
Yeah, I think in that same vein of, him forcing, whether it's, forcing fumbles, forcing bad throws that turn into interceptions, it's making a not just a consistent impact, but a playmaking impact. And I also think, Jesse Minter, the theme of the team so far this offseason is, being at our best when our best is needed, right? And that Mike Green is the kind of guy, that explosive edge rusher, that the Ravens need him to be at his best when the best is needed. Late in games, when opposing teams are trying to catch up and drive, that is when you need a guy like Mike Green. You need your edge rusher to come in and be great then. And so I think that's the other thing, kind of the next level of, you've made the double jump to the NFL, and now you're going to put in this situational pass rushing role. And the reason, like you talked about, there are a lot of great names on that list is because that role can be really, really important, especially to a front-running team like the Ravens.
Yeah, a team that, you're right. I mean, they'll have a lot of closeout games, and he should be a part of that. And they may play a bunch of race car in those situations. And it may be a case where they want multiple outside linebackers, whether it's 3 or even 4 on the field in those situations. So that'll be a lot of fun. I think it's worth taking a moment right now. I hope you got time for this. talk about mission statements in general, because the best when the best is needed has been the Jesse Minter thing. And he's brought it up, you know, every time he's been at the podium, it's come up several times, you know, and I would say your best employees at any company, your best and most valuable employees, look with a jaundiced eye at mission statements and watch action. They watch action. So, you know, I heard for years, I had worked for a president who was a mission statement guy. And I know he knows who he is. And I know the other people who worked with me know this to be true as well. And it was always there has to be something more behind that. So you have to watch action that goes with that. And by the way, he didn't let me down in terms of action most of the time. He was on target with that too. I said, I don't want to say that, but I want to see a coach that really turns that into action and doesn't stray too heavily into mission statementitis, where that's something that they're trying to tie in. We heard Derrick Henry at the podium the other day. Derrick Henry is not buying into the BS. He's exactly the kind of guy who should. I mean, he basically, every question that was turned to him about culture and differences between Harbaugh and Minter and this and that, he turned it back around to, look, I'm just trying to learn a new system, learn the terminology, work hard, and do my job kind of thing. And that's the correct way to look at it. Great employees look at their job from first principles like that, and they do the right thing for the company, and they save you a lot of money. And lousy employees, you know, are really swayed by mission, by things, or not lousy employees, but other people can be really swayed by mission statements, and I'm just not as impressed by that.
Well, okay, so there's a couple things I want to unpack there. The first is how this specifically pertains to Green, because 3rd and 9 with the game on the line, if I'm an offensive coordinator in the NFL, I'm worried about probably in this order, well, I don't even know what order I would put Jones, Matabike, and Hendrickson, but I'm worried about those three guys and not Hamilton, Mike Green. Yeah. Whoever's blocking Mike Green is going to be on an island. They're going to have to take care of him. That's why, you know, I'm talking about these be at our best when our best is needed. He's going to have those opportunities in those big moments and to see if he can show up and finish a play and end a game. So that's the first thing. The other thing is Jesse Minter.
Can I just respond to that first part just for a second? Because that thing you mentioned, he absolutely has to do the things. And when he's on an island, that he certainly needs to do everything he can to get to the quarterback in that particular situation. I want to see motor. I want to see his best set of moves. I want to see him thinking about how he's going to approach the play before it occurs. All that's true. But those are the building blocks that break that down. It's not the mission statement that got him there. The mission statement is a goal. The first principles are what's important.
Well, so a couple of things. I'm not advertising the mission statement. I'm just saying that is what I'm saying. Is he going to do those things? Is he going to do the things that you're saying? Right. The other thing is, I guess there's some nuance in the mission statement thing too. The first is Derrick Henry's Derrick Henry. I'm not sure anyone, I'm not sure he's giving different answers in any way. Right. The other is the second is there's also the question of like, yeah, Minter's a Harbaugh guy. This is this isn't, how much of a different culture is it really when Minter was raised by John and Jim Harbaugh in the world of football? And the third thing is he's a new head coach. I mean, he has to install a new culture. There's the PR aspect of it. That line, that is a great line. Everybody loves that line. There's a reason I brought it up today. So I also might be being a little hard on Minter, just because, you know, he does have to come in and put his stamp on the team and say those things. It's, and I'm not saying necessarily as part of his football facing job. I mean, as his face of the team towards the public job.
Okay.
He needs to be sending those messages.
All right. Well, that's fair. I mean, the usage of it yesterday, the mission statement usage, was in relation to the medicine ball throwing competition they had at the end of practice. Now, was that a good thing? I say yes. It's always a good thing. It's an opportunity for bonding, to get your players competing against each other. Offense versus defense, us versus them, has always been something the Ravens have fostered. I think it's been a good thing in practice. I like the way that Terrell Suggs always tried to make that into a big deal. And, you know, talk about that's why we win. You know, we go after those loose balls. You guys don't kind of think it. But the medicine ball thing, for him to go up to the podium and say, hey, you know, this is part of the theme we're trying to promote here of be the best when the best is needed and you don't know what's coming. Well, I would argue that's not a time when the best is needed. You know, that is exactly a time when, you know, it doesn't matter if you're at your best or not. Let's have some fun with this. Let's bond as a team. But the best when the best is needed for that? Nah, come on. Drop the mission statement for a moment.
I think you're being too hard on it, Kev. Maybe I'm just a little. Oh, absolutely. And maybe I'm a little cynical about it, but I mean that's tailor made for the fans and media to eat right up. I mean that's a big part of the calculus to me. Even having that at the end of the viewing period where reporters could see it. And having a medicine ball throwing instead of the 2-minute planks that they had yesterday, that would be a lot less interesting to circulate on social media. There's all of those elements of it to me where I'm like, okay, he's doing the things.
All right, you're if you're talking about it's a big floppy green guy out of the parking lot of a used car lot, I buy that. You know, if you're trying to sell it to the public.
Not to be too cynical, but there's a performative aspect to all of this. And certainly as a new head coach from a fan base that's been begging from one, he knows that the team knows that there's certain things he's got to put on in public. You know, I'm not sure. I'm sure there's going to be like behind the scenes clips of him saying at our best when our best is needed. That's something they're going to promote. It's catchy.
Here's what I would like to see in the comments from people. Okay. And I don't ask for reaction in the comments because I'm frankly not an engagement farmer like a lot of other people, but I would like to hear this. What's the silliest use of mission statement you encountered in your career from anybody? It typically will be a president of the company whose job is to, you know, they feel like the job is always to inspire. And that is an important part of it. But give me the silliest use of mission statement that you can recall. I'd love to hear these examples. I love a lot of this corporate mumbo jumbo as it comes through. Nick, always great talking football with you. Can you tell folks where they can find your work online?
Yeah, you can find my work at Baltimore Beatdown, the managing editor over there. Can also find me on Twitter at Nick, N-I-K-O-N-O-S-Ball. I'll be at spring and summer practices with comparing notes with Ken and bothering him on the sidelines when he's trying to watch football. And so be on the lookout for all of that coverage as well.
Now, one of my favorite people to watch practice with is Nick here. He knows the game well, and it's a lot of fun. The group in general is very good. And so enjoy it, but it's a lot of fun. And other folks out there, please use hashtag Film Study Mailbag for your questions. I'll try and get them to the appropriate show or answer them in a 1 or 3 minute video myself. And I've appreciated the content there. Reddit people, thanks a lot for all your contributions to the show. And I'll try and figure out a way to get your questions that is not Twitter based only if you use hashtag Film Study Ravens within a Twitter post. So within a Reddit post, I will get to it. Nick, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.